You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. As we record this evening, the United States has moved more military troops, ships, and hardware into the Middle East than at any time since the beginning of the Iraq War. The target this time, though, is the Islamic Republic of Iran and apparently its nuclear arsenal. So what happens to a nuclear stockpile when a government falls, as could easily happen with Iran? Tonight, we're going to dispel some myths by talking with David Albright, the founder of the Institute for Science and International Security. David, thank you for coming in.
Oh, no, glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, I may get some things wrong, and I invite clarification and correction, but what kind of nuclear weapons and stockpile does Iran have?
Well, fortunately, Iran doesn't have any nuclear weapons as of today, but it has a tremendous amount of nuclear weapons capabilities. And for example, it has what's called highly enriched uranium, well over 400 kilograms of it, and it can be used directly to make a nuclear weapon. So in a sense, you have the most important component of a nuclear weapon already in Iran. They also have radioactive sources, which can be used in terrorist attacks, could be dispersed accidentally. They have nuclear power reactors. As we know from the situation in Ukraine, can be very vulnerable to sabotage military strikes. And you have to worry a great deal that it could have a catastrophic accident. And Iran has one of those at Bushehr. It also has a research reactor right in the center of Tehran, which could also be at risk. Then you have all kinds of things associated with a nuclear weapons program. Iran has worked decades on making nuclear weapons. It has all kinds of classified information and it put together itself or acquired abroad. It did a lot of development work, so it has all kinds of test results that would be very valuable to someone who wanted to make a nuclear weapon. So while it doesn't have nuclear weapons, it's very close to that category of a nuclear weapon state. And so it has a lot of assets. It also has these nuclear power reactor, which also could pose a catastrophic risk.
Let's talk about what history tells us can happen to nuclear material when a government falls. And governments do sometimes fall and have historically. So what should we be thinking about and worrying about here?
Well, I think the first important case was the collapse of the Soviet Union, where there it went from a very tight system to one that was just in chaos. Nuclear weapons were vulnerable. Stocks of the highly enriched uranium, plus also separated plutonium, were in places that are not well protected. And I think when the United States realized that, it mobilized tremendous resources to work with the people, the scientists and officials in the ex-Soviet states to try to gain control over those materials. Now, fortunately, the Soviet scientists were extremely loyal, even in a sense, to their projects, maybe not necessarily to the past leadership, but certainly to their projects. And so they joined in this effort to make sure this stuff didn't leak out. Nonetheless, the CIA and other U.S. intelligence agencies have assessed that some of this material, plutonium or highly enriched uranium, did go missing. We know cases where scientists took stuff home, and so not all of it was properly accounted for, but the vast bulk of it was. And so that was a success story. Also, part of it was to get countries like Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus to give up their nuclear weapons, and that was accomplished. Ukraine obviously has second thoughts about that, given that the security guarantees that came with that didn't work. And so there you had a problem where in the future, some countries may, or factions, I should say, in a sense, Ukraine was a faction or a state of the Soviet Union, may not be as willing to give up things because of the experience of Ukraine. There are other cases, too, where things were more chaotic. Was probably the best example is Iraq. There are also chaos that's still being worked on in Syria. But in Iraq, you had this misconception by the U.S. government that Iran had this big WMD program, And so it mobilized all kinds of efforts to find those WMD. But in that process, it didn't take the precautions needed to protect the assets that were there. So there was a huge nuclear research center called Tuatha. When the US Army took over the site, it had been abandoned. The military people involved didn't know it was a nuclear site. My institute was very much involved in trying to figure out things going on in Iraq. We didn't believe in any of the nuclear WMD stories, but we're worried about some of the assets that remained. One of the embedded journalists called me from Tuatha and said, "You know, what is this place? And there's uranium here." He didn't really know what it was, but it had actually been looted. It was a storage site at Tuatha that had been looted. And I promptly called my contact in the State Department, who then got to the Pentagon to say, "Look, you've got to protect this stuff." But some of the, and in that case, fortunately, no one was interested in the uranium. Well, and uranium has a value on the black market. And fortunately, the people who looted it were interested in the barrels rather than the uranium inside the barrels. So that was a not a high risk case, but nonetheless showing that even when a country goes in looking for WMD, it's not prepared to protect the assets. There were also highly classified nuclear sensitive information in Iraq. There was a scientist who wanted to trade kind of the crown jewels of a uranium enrichment program run with, I guess, centrifuges, and wanted to trade that for he and his family coming to the United States. And in that case, I fortunately he called me. I knew him from the days when I was an inspector in Iraq in the 1990s, and we were actually searching for him at the time. Again, independent of the US government, but trying to search for him, teamed up with some journalists. And fortunately, he called me and I was able to facilitate a trade with the CIA. But it was very difficult, where again, they weren't prepared. They told me if one person will take him out, he wanted to come out with eight other family members. And they said no. And they kind of double crossed him. And we had to go through tremendous effort in order to rectify the situation and get him and his family to the United States. Now, he was already being threatened in Iraq. I mean, people who cooperated with the Americans were being identified and singled out for essentially killing. And so if the thing with the CIA hadn't worked out, he may have tried to go someplace else because he desperately wanted to get out of Baghdad. And so who knows, he could have gone to Iran, and he had tremendously valuable information in his possession. So again, the US wasn't prepared, and it worked out all right, but it's a lesson that isn't very encouraging. Where things did work out better was in the case of South Africa, where there the country voluntarily gave up nuclear weapons and cooperated with the US government and other governments, Russian government and the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the inspectors went in and looked around and said, "Oh, look, there's a lot of, you did destroy the program, you dismantled in a very good way. But by the way, there's a lot of sensitive nuclear weapons components lying around in your ex-weapons facilities." And South Africa agreed to dismantle and get rid of that. So the country did a good job at starting the process, but by cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, it was able to do an even better job to get rid of, in a sense, stray nuclear weapons components that could have been of interest to the black market.
I hear a lot of sort of lessons learned here. So, what should the United States do here with respect to this material that could be traded on the black market, recognizing if the government of Iran falls, there's going to be widespread unrest. Unquestionably, there certainly would be looting because people panic. What would be your advice to anybody who happens to be prepared to go in the event that the government falls?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. government should prepare and learn from the lessons from these previous cases. You would hope that if the government falls, that it's replaced by another one, and that it would be very inexperienced. There'd be large areas out of its control and institutions out of its control. And so you would certainly want to hope for the situation where you could team up with the government and then start to, with their assistance, gain control over these assets. I think it's also important that if Bashir is safe, that and that requires the United States to work with with Russia, which Russians are at the site. They provide the fuel. They've provided a lot of the safety analysis for the plant. And so it's important to, if there's a real risk of something falling apart, that the United States is working with Russia to secure that site, where it principally would be Russia doing it, but it would have U.S. assistance. And the goal would be to just perhaps put it in a safe shutdown mode until things are more stable. But even if in a safe shutdown mode, you have to maintain electricity to the site to make sure that the residual fission products, which produce heat, don't cause a meltdown in the reactor and then a large release of radiation. So it requires real tending to. And I think the United States also may need to be thinking of specialized military slash scientific teams to go search out things and seek the cooperation of scientists and officials to make sure that they know where everything is.
And, listening to you, the idea of dealing with Russia right now seems nearly impossible, but I'm sure on some issues we still do cooperate with them. But let's talk about what sites you recommend be secured and why, because of your knowledge of that country, maybe, and where these things might be held.
Well, I think I've mentioned Bushehr. I mean, that's a very well-defined plant that makes electricity, and that's down in southern Iran. The highly enriched uranium, as far as we outsiders can tell, that includes the International Atomic Energy Agency, is that there's three main nuclear sites: Natanz, Fordow, and Esfahan, and they're fairly large sites, but those would need to be secured. The highly enriched uranium may be buried in a mountain, but people can get into it, and so you would want to make sure that no one has that opportunity. The Tehran Research Reactor is a special case because it's right in the middle of Tehran, and you really don't want that reactor to have an accident because the people are right there. And that would need to be put into some kind of safe shutdown mode. The more complicated part is where all the nuclear weapons design information is. There, it's going to take probably special work to try to ferret out or discover, perhaps offer rewards for coming forth, the nuclear weapons scientists that have this kind of classified information, because I don't think a new government would necessarily know where those people are, and in fact, who those people are. And if there's chaos, then it's sort of every person for themselves. So you would have to try to lure them into cooperation and then seek out others. It'd be very complicated. And that's why I think it's important to think about this in advance. Even if you think the chance is small of a regime collapse, that it's one of these cases where you have low probability, but potentially very high consequences, very negative consequences.
Well, I guess it depends on who you talk to, right? Some people think that it will collapse, and other people think that that possibility is remote. But I hear you that the consequences are high. Now, in reviewing those potential sites, would a country like Iran, which I think of as a petro state, how many reactors do they have across that country? And sort of what is the answer to dealing with that? I imagine that some of them provide electricity to the citizens of Iran, and probably they can't just easily be taken offline.
Well, yeah, there's one operational nuclear power reactor, and it's 1,000 megawatt electric, and so it provides a significant amount of electricity to the region and that it's in. And the Tehran Research Reactor is a very small reactor, but it makes medical isotopes. It has a value for hospitals and treatment of patients. So I think if it is a collapse of the regime, then I think the only safe thing to do is shut these reactors down. I mean, it's too hard to maintain a reactor, and if it produces electricity, it has to go someplace. And if there's instability in the electrical companies, potential sabotage attacks, I mean, it's better just to shut it down. And that's what they did in Ukraine with Zaporizhia in the end, with all the battles going on. And it just really the only thing to do was to go to really shut them down and keep the electricity on to make sure the safety systems work. But you were not exporting electricity and trying to really run it at near full power, which in the collapsing state is a very dangerous prospect.
Let me ask you though, having been an inspector, yours is a somewhat, optimistic discipline. Let's be fair. You do these things because you can identify things and get results. But I'm looking at the U.S. military and intelligence agencies, which I have tremendous faith in. But is this sort of stabilization of this material and or shutting down these plants? Is this something that the U.S. military and intelligence agencies could certainly do, in your opinion?
They have to team up with scientists, particularly the ones at the Department of Energy. And there's a lot of people here. There's people in Europe that can be brought in. I mean, one of the things that the unfortunate reality is, if you're going to look around for things, you better have military with you. I mean, it'd be very dangerous to just go out and start looking around for dangerous nuclear assets, because there's certainly going to be other people interested in those things. And there may still be loyalists that you can encounter. So, and in the case of Iraq, when the U.S. did send in inspectors, in the end, some of them were attacked and hurt pretty badly. So once the insurgency got going through the summer and fall of 2003, but the U.S. can do it. Whether it will or not, I don't know. I have heard nothing. And so partly why we wrote this op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and raised this is that we're worried that it's not being thought through. And some of the same mistakes made in Iraq could be made in Iran. But Iran really does have the nuclear weapons capabilities that are quite dangerous. And it has an operating nuclear power reactor. Iraq had some very dangerous materials like highly classified gas centrifuge information that would be very valuable. Iran would have snapped it up in a second if it had gotten its hand on this person. But Iran has vastly more nuclear assets. And one hopes that if the United States is going to move in and destabilize the regime, potentially collapse it, that they're thinking through how to make sure that these nuclear assets don't become, you know, another horrible radiological disaster.
Okay, well, I'm just going to assume that everybody's thought all of this through. They have an ironclad plan or not, but we would like to believe that some lessons were learned from our mistakes in Iraq. But what is your prediction, if you will, or how do you see this unfolding in a best case scenario?
Well, I have to believe that war could break out. And I think many people, probably you, think there's a pretty good chance that Trump will order an attack. I mean, the Iranian regime isn't very flexible on these nuclear questions, and Trump is asking them to end uranium enrichment, which they've ended. But then it's also Trump's asking for limitations on ballistic missiles and then stop supporting proxies. And so the regime is not very willing to do those things. And so it very well could end up in a war. And it's hard to predict. I mean, we know what the war looked like in June. It was a targeted effort to destroy the nuclear program's most sensitive parts and the ballistic missile program. Then to experiment, I don't know how else to put it, experiment with attacking the security forces inside Iran. The Israelis targeted quite a few of the internal security headquarters and things like that. And we know that they've successfully got rid of most of the sensitive nuclear program. There are remnants like the highly enriched uranium that are dangerous, but got rid of most of it. They got rid of quite a bit of the missile program. And when they attacked the repressive forces in the regime, it killed a lot of people, evidently, but it didn't really affect things as we all witness with this horrible massacre of Iranians in January. So I think whatever is planned, if they really want to change the regime, it's going to be a much bigger attack than what we saw in June. And I think it'll go over many, many weeks. I mean, that went on for, I forget, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, probably even longer. And they'll be looking at a whole additional range of targets that increases the chance of destabilizing the regime.
The idea of cooperating with Russia seems to me interesting. And part of that is, I wonder, because they've received a lot of drones, the Russians have, that they have purposed against Ukraine during this conflict. My question is, what would bring a country like Russia and a leader like Putin to the table to assist in stabilizing or containing any nuclear material that could go into the open market, for lack of a better term, or cause a disaster? What incentive would he have to be helpful in this scenario when it would appear to me that he's depending on Iran for a lot of the drones that he's using in the Ukraine war? He's losing 1,700 soldiers a week. I just don't know what would be in it to him. Based on your experience, what have you seen? What would bring him to cooperate?
It's cooperation limited to the Bushehr reactor, which is a Russian-built reactor, and they don't want to see that meltdown. One is it'd be a horrible catastrophe, but two, it'd be very bad for business. It's really the cooperation would be limited to Bushehr to make sure that that site is secure and isn't going to have attacks. And some of it would be making sure Russia understands we're not going to attack Bushehr. I mean, that was done in the June war. Israel sat down with Russia and said, we will not attack Bushehr. And so that would be the limit of cooperation. On the Ukrainian situation and the Shahids, we do a lot of work at my institute on how the transfer went from Iran to Russia. Work every day to try to disrupt the supply chain and do other things to try to hurt that cooperation. So I don't have any benign feelings about Russia and Putin. But in this case, a nuclear power reactor is just a very dangerous machine, and you don't want the radioactive material to get out.
Okay, and presumably to your point, it would be bad for business. So maybe that would be an incentive. Well, I very much appreciate talking to you tonight. Thank you for your op-ed piece. We'll hyperlink it in the notes to the cast, and we'll track and see what you guys are doing over the coming months. And hopefully, God forbid, anything should happen. A lot of thought has been given to the issues that you raise about securing this material. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. All right, we're going to move on now to a few national security news items. The first is Russia continues to crack down on foreign developed technology, this time banning WhatsApp and throttling Telegram, which, by the way, was developed by Russian Pavel Durov, who said that the replacement app known as Max that's being promoted by the Kremlin is actually nothing more than a Kremlin-controlled surveillance tool. It will be used to squelch dissent. So again, controlling information, we're going to be talking in a couple of weeks to Seth Jones of CSIS, who can discuss the numbers of casualties and how Russia is doing in the war. And the picture is not as sunny as the Russian people are hearing. I would note that press accounts from mid-February show that over 6,000 Starlink terminals were smuggled into Iran at a time when the government of Iran has also attempted to control information. So information has certainly become a part of the new warfare. This isn't new, but the manner in which it's being carried out is something to watch. Now, the sanctions dodging story of the week was reported in the Financial Times. And apparently, an email blunder has exposed the $90 billion worth of Russian oil that is being moved by a smuggling ring that included 48 different companies set up to smuggle the oil between Russia and, it looks like, India. These companies were constantly changing names and then vanishing in the night. However, what didn't change was a single email server that they all shared. And the Financial Times was able to identify 144 web domains that were on this one server that were linked to the names, the changing names of these companies. And interestingly enough, they weren't that careful because there was a paper trail in Indian custom records, which revealed that all of these company names were companies receiving Russian oil. So this comes at a time when Modi just promised President Trump that he would, you know, adhere to some of these sanctions in exchange for tariff relief, which it appears the Supreme Court decision may have sort of eliminated that as an issue in their negotiations. We'll get to the Supreme Court decision in the coming weeks as well. That's it. Thank you for listening to NSLT. Please subscribe to NSLT. That helps us amplify our civil discourse, our content. You can find us, of course, not just on Apple, but we're on Spotify and Amazon. If you subscribe, that helps us. So remember, our unity is also a key feature of our national security. When we can't agree, we can agree to listen to one another, which we try to do on this podcast. And that includes having difficult conversations about the possible secondary consequences of something like a failed Iran, which, you know, obviously could be quite dire. So we remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, as long as we remain willing to engage in critical thinking. So we tried to do that here as well. The writer and producer and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is Francis Burkham. The tireless and amazing Holly McMahon is also co-producer of this podcast. Our program manager is the lovely Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. And social media and research support comes from Alana Cooper-Smith. But of course, we are forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security who pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.